while visiting the summer school organised by the Buddhist Society when there was an incident at breakfast. Reading number 4, please.
In the dining hall, there were separate tables for vegetarians and non-vegetarians. At breakfast the first day, I joined the vegetarians, among whom were people I knew. In previous years, monks attending the summer school had always eaten by themselves, thus reinforcing the Theravadan separation between monks and the lay community. And the fact that I chose to do otherwise occasioned a certain amount of astonishment. But it also gave rise to a good deal of pleasure, so that I still have a vivid impression of the delight with which people received me when I sat down at their table that morning.
So as time went by, Bante's views on monks and the nature of practice continued to develop. Views about that distinction between the monks and the laity, and about the rules for monks, which are known as the Vinaya. So he was thinking really deeply about what made someone a Dharma practitioner, the essence of it rather than the rules. And he started to experiment and deviate from these rules. And of course, not everyone approved. Reading number 5, please.
According to the Vinaya, it was an offence for a monk to partake of solid food after midday. In India, I had observed this rule strictly for a number of years, and it was official policy at the House of Vihara. During the last few years of my stay in India, however, I had adopted a more flexible attitude. It was clear to me that the principle, as distinct from the rule, was moderation in eating, and that this was a principle to be honoured by monk and layman alike. In India, I had always shaved my head, but in England, I had allowed my hair to grow a little, and this had been commented on unfavourably by some of the more rigid English Theravadins. Not that all comments had been unfavourable. Some of the people who attended my classes were pleased to see me looking more human and less ascetic.
Number 6. So, another thing which caused speculation and disapproval was Bante's friendship with a man called Terry. And this was an important friendship for both of them, and an entirely platonic one. Terry was heterosexual. He had relationships with, I think, 3 women during the time that Bante knew him. Their friendship was unusually close for men in that era. It was a deep bond, but not a sexual one. Terry suffered from severe depression and anxiety, stemming back to childhood experiences. And this was often a worry for Bante, even to the extent of wondering at times if his friend would take his own life. And Terry's depression is often in the background in Bante's diaries during these years. So as he goes about his more public life of teaching and running the Vihara, there's that life, and then there's a sense of the ups and downs of his friend's depression. And Terry had not wanted other people to know about his condition. So it was something that, in a way, Bante felt he, you know, was something that he couldn't then share with others, but was painfully aware of. Reading number 6, please.
I found it difficult to say just when I decided that my future lay in the West and not, as I had hitherto supposed, in India. A number of factors contributed to my gradual realisation that I could work for the good of Buddhism more effectively there than in India. I still sought to resolve the differences between the Buddhist Society and the Sangha Trust. Some of the people attending my lectures and classes had come to regard themselves as my disciples and looked to me for guidance in their study and practice of the Dharma, and I felt it would be irresponsible of me to abandon them.
So, in September 1966, when he'd been in the UK for about 2 years, he returned to India to say farewells to his teachers and to other friends. So there's one of the pictures of him during these 4 months, I think it was, of, in a way, diving back a little bit into his life in India. And he met with various of his friends and teachers, including the Dalai Lama, during that trip. So he spent 4 months in India, accompanied by his friend Terry. And while in Kalimpong, so I think that was a good few months into the visit, he was in Kalimpong and he received another letter from the English Sangha Trust, again out of the blue. It expressed appreciation of his service to the Dharma in the UK, in England, but said they thought his behaviour was not fitting for a monk, and they suggested that he resign from the Vihara and stay in India, where surely he had much to occupy him. Reading number 7, please.
Do you know what this means? I asked Terry when I had finished reading the letter. It means a new Buddhist movement. The words sprang spontaneously to my lips. It was as if the trust's letter, coming as it did like a flash of lightning, had suddenly revealed possibilities that had hitherto been shrouded in darkness. Though I had long felt that the Buddhist movement in Britain might need a fresh impetus, I had certainly never considered the possibility of my taking steps so radical as that of starting a new Buddhist movement. But now I saw that a new Buddhist movement was what was really needed.
So it was quite a moment. He says later that although the movement was founded in the UK, actually it was conceived in that moment in Kalimpong. So a great flurry of letters followed, arriving in Kalimpong from the UK. Some were more unpleasant, with quite slanderous allegations. Many were very supportive letters from friends and other students, defending Bante and indignant at the actions of Maurice Walsh and the English Sangha Trust. And it was clear that there was quite a showdown going on in London, with many people in uproar and calling for Bante to be reinstated at the Vihara. So meanwhile in India, Bante was given his teacher's blessings for the new direction that he was thinking of going in. And they were not particularly troubled by the news in these letters from England. Perhaps in their own way they had kind of seen it all before. So he returned to London in February of 1967. He met with the supporters who'd been campaigning for his reinstatement in the Vihara. And in a letter to all the members, friends of the English Sangha Trust, he wrote, "Despite the upheavals of the past few months, I remain optimistic about the future of Buddhism in this country. My determination to continue my work here is unshakable." So soon after Bante's return to the UK, Christmas Humphreys apologised for his part in the saga. Maurice Walsh and the other trustees of the English Sangha Trust wrote a piece in their newsletter retracting their allegations. But Maurice himself remained antagonistic, and Bante was not asked to return to the Vihara. In the mix of all that had gone on, there was probably different opinions, different views about Buddhism. Maurice's views on Buddhism clearly differed from Bante's. And in some of his editorials of the Buddhist Journal, that he was part of publishing, Maurice wrote that the Sangha Trust was committed to going back to the Theravada, and also stated that there was no such thing as a lay Sangha. So he's clearly going in a different direction. Dr. Konza, who's another author you might have heard of from that era on Buddhism, he was a friend of Bante's, and he later told him that he thought the trouble had started, as it often does, with gossip. Gossip among a few staunch Theravadan practitioners, which then fed off the homophobic norms of the era. So reading number 8.
One lesson to be drawn from the events of the last 6 months related to the gossip about my relationship with Terry, which it was alleged was of a homosexual nature. Christmas Humphreys pointed out that the English middle class mind had such an abhorrence of homosexuality that even the appearance of it was sufficient to warrant a man's banishment from decent society. What this meant in effect was that it was difficult for men to develop more than ordinarily close friendships without incurring the suspicion of homosexuality, and in some cases the unpleasant and even painful consequences of such suspicion. But friendship occupied an important place in Buddhism, the Buddha having gone so far as to declare on one occasion that spiritual friendship, Kalyana Mitrasa, was not the half, but indeed the whole of the spiritual life. Middle-class fear or hatred of homosexuality thus stood in the way of the full practice of the Dharma. The lesson I drew from this circumstance was that our new Buddhist movement would have to be free from homophobia, as it came to be called, if spiritual friendship was to flourish within it. Indeed, it would have to be free from homophobia if it was to be truly Buddhist. Buddhism is a universal teaching, and as such, its attitude is one of goodwill, of metta, towards all living beings, irrespective of race, nationality, social position, gender, or sexual orientation.
So, the door of the Hampstead Vihara had closed, which in many ways I think was quite a relief for Bante. And another door opened. One of Bante's students, a man called Emil Boyne, ran a Japanese shop called Sakura in Monmouth Street. There's the sign to the Sakura shop. And he offered the basement of his shop as a venue for meditation and Dharma classes. And on April the 7th, 1967, in that basement, there was a dedication ceremony which was held for the new Tri Ratna meditation and shrine room. Interesting that back then it was called Tri Ratna. And now we are. So that marked the birth of the Friends of the Western Sangha, as it was then called. So Bante writes, the new Buddhist movement was no longer just an idea, much less still only a dream. It had begun to be a reality. So it's the 50th anniversary of that event that we'll be celebrating in April this year. Some of you might know we're doing a Sangha art project, which will hit you soon, next door, to mark the 50th birthday. So it's the 50th anniversary birthday of that occasion, where I think that was the first time that the dedication ceremony, which we use, was first written by Bante for that occasion. And that was the sign at the time for the, let's say, Western Buddhist Order. So all this time, Bante continued with his very active life of running classes, meeting up with students, studying, reading, and giving talks. Reading number 9, please, our last reading.
I spent the rest of the morning preparing for the lecture I was to give at the Reading University Buddhist Society that evening on mind, reactive and creative. The reactive mind, the ordinary, everyday mind most of us used most of the time, didn't act, but only reacted to external stimuli. It was mechanical, repetitive, and above all, unaware. The creative mind, on the contrary, was not determined by external stimuli. It responded rather than reacted, functioning out of the depths of its own intrinsic nature. It loved where there was no reason to love, was happy where there was no reason for happiness. Thus the creative mind was independent, spontaneous and aware. The spiritual life was one in which we consistently chose to be creative, to be aware rather than unaware. Such was the gist of my lecture, which lasted well over an hour, and was followed by a lively discussion as a result of which I was home not much before midnight.
So, April 1968, we're nearing the end of this particular talk, this phase. So that month in 1968 was a very particular month for Bante. It was a time of tragedy as well as joy. After years of struggling with depression, his friend Terry committed suicide. A memorial service was held at the house of Mafalda, his girlfriend at the time, and the FWBO newsletter noted, "The simple but moving ceremony was conducted by the venerable Sangharakshita and attended by many friends who had loved Terry for his great qualities of head and heart." Earlier that month, there had been a very joyful occasion, the first ordinations into the Western Buddhist Order. They took place a year after that dedication of the Sakura basement. So it was the 7th of April 1968, and there's a rather fuzzy photo of that occasion. And the first person to be ordained into the Western Buddhist Order was a woman called Sarah Boyne, who is there, and she was the wife of Emil Boyne, who ran the shop in Monmouth Street. So there were in total 12 people who had their public ordinations that day. They were the first founding members of the Western Buddhist Order. So thus ends the rather turbulent and very pivotal years in the late 1960s, which led to the founding of the movement and the order, without which none of us be sitting here in this place.